Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a conversation originally recorded in 1993, examining the Clinton administration's proposed healthcare program. Joining this discussion are Rita Ricardo Campbell, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Kevin Hopkins, Senior Domestic Policy Aide during the Reagan administration. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, it's good to see you again, Kevin.
Good to see you, Rita.
We're here, I guess, to discuss the great problems of the healthcare crisis in the United States, which everyone agrees exists. I think the extraordinary rise in the healthcare costs have caught some people by surprise, even though a lot of people have felt we've been in crisis for years. Mm-hmm. Also, the extraordinary increase in numbers of people who do not have insurance, somewhere around 35 million, which is only about 13% of the U.S. population. And additionally, recent stories on U.S. high levels of technology and its contribution with the high percentage of specialists in relation to the number of primary care physicians, mm-hmm. which makes the United States unique in the world. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I think it certainly does make the United States unique in the world. The United States has the highest level of medical care and certainly the highest technological expertise anywhere in the world. The problem, as many critics see it, is that we have too much technology and that we should trim back technology, that we should use high-tech items less, and in general develop a much more primary care, prevention-centered type of healthcare system. And I think one of the first questions we need to explore, since you raised that very important issue, is that feasible and is it desirable?
I believe it's desirable. I think the United States has more wider dissemination of modern technology in medical care than other countries. Mm-hmm. This not only has a high level, but it's much more available in the United States. We have more MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging, per 100,000 population than elsewhere in the world, for example.
Sure, we have eight times as much access here as in Canada, for instance, for MRIs, and similar levels for many other high-tech procedures.
But how feasible it is to get from where we are to there of more primary care, I don't know. And I think this is one of the problems that would have to be solved. We have 2/3 of our physicians are specialists and only 1/3 of them are primary care physicians. In Canada, it's the reverse.
Well, that's certainly the intention of the resource-based value, relative value system that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services adopted last year for Medicare, that extends the Medicare hospital price controls to physicians, and they increase the payment rates for primary care physicians, and they reduce the rates for many of the specialties, and in many cases to as low as half of what private insurance normally pays for specialty care. And certainly that is what takes place in Canada, too. Canada is very primary care oriented. The question I think we need to explore as sort of a prelude to a discussion of the overall health cost problem is this issue of is high technology care superfluous? It seems to be conventional wisdom that there is so much high technology care out there that we can just eliminate. We can go to primary care specialists, primary care physicians, and we can emphasize primary care over high technology care. And I think many people, especially in the Clinton administration, are willing to and eager to make that transition. But there are some very troubling questions too. For instance, how do you diagnose a brain tumor if you're a primary care physician? How do you conduct emergency heart surgery? How do you do a hip replacement? How do you do any of these sophisticated operations that can only be done by a specialist?
Well, I agree with you, and I find troublesome some very recent pronouncements that I have read about. For example, the Public Health Service issued some regulations asking ophthalmologists to look very carefully before they did cataract surgery, mm-hmm. on the assumption that apparently older people are overusing it. Now, having been a recent person who has benefited from that, mm-hmm. surgery, which has a lens implant, I find very understandable the great increase in numbers of people that are wanting to have cataract and lens implant surgery. The 1.4 million this past year is because it's just now been spreading around. What a great boon it is. Mm-hmm. And maybe you ought to explore the issue of whether people aren't willing to pay, that is, people under Medicare Part B, willing to pay some of that fee themselves, those who can. That's another excellent.
Well, there's another very good example of that is a form of ear implant, an intercochlear ear implant, that Medicare reimburses at such a low rate that only about 60 operations or 60 implants are able to take place each year. And of the five firms in the United States that were manufacturing that implant, three of them have stopped doing it altogether. And the major manufacturer, which was working very aggressively to develop a more sophisticated version that would improve elderly people's hearing even further, has ceased that next step up technology. Canada faces a similar problem. In another very important procedure that I just mentioned for elderly people, and that's hip replacements, which in many parts of Canada, you can wait 2 years or more to have a hip replacement. The delays aren't that long here in the United States, but under the new Medicare payment rules, in many of the big cities, payments for hip replacements are about 60 to 70% of the normal private insurance rate. And obviously what that's going to do is it's going to make physicians a lot less willing to carry out those operations. And the question we need to explore in this regard to segue into the overall health cost containment issue is concerns the hidden costs and the hidden values of health treatment. Not having a cataract surgery, not having a hearing implant, not having a hip replacement does not show up in statistics of any kind, because those people do not die. They survive. They continue on the statistical books as no different if they have the treatment versus if they do not have the treatment. But as you know personally, those kind of operations can make an enormous difference in the quality of life. To condemn, as Canada does, an elderly person to go for 2 years unable to walk or to walk very well while they await a hip replacement may not affect it certainly saves money on the books of Canada's healthcare system.
It loses money in national income. These people might have been able to work. I found a new lease.
You certainly did. But even if they don't work, even if they're retired,
I agree.
They lose out considerably in the quality of life. And are we going too far in what I call green eyeshade cost control, in looking at just the economic implications of medical restraint, medical care restraints, without looking at the human side of things?
I think too few people recognize that the reimbursement, it causes rationing, the same as it is criticized that prices in a competitive system acts as a rationer. It has been fascinating to me that I guess the Canadian government, even more so than the U.S., but the U.S. in respect to resource-based relative value schedule applied comparable worth to physicians' incomes, mm-hmm. which is a notion that has been shot down throughout the country in respect to women's income as mm-hmm. women and men. Mm-hmm. So that this has resulted in trying to cut back some of the surgery, mm-hmm. and high-tech surgery, which often, as you state, rewards very high benefits. Basically, surgeons can be held at fault for some of the reaction. I recall talking with a University of California, San Francisco physician who tried to lower the charges he did for particular, say, surgery. It wasn't cataracts, but it might well have been. And his fellow physicians wouldn't let him do this.
Oh, really?
Really. And basically, it has been the false kind of guild-like institutions and associations of physicians that have kept up the rates, even though the time involved in the operation has been so greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I may hop on the cataract because I know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, you spent a week in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now it's outpatient surgery in less than an hour. Now that is an extraordinary mm-hmm. increase in technology.
It certainly is.
Level. And this is true of lots of other operations.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this morning's newspaper had an interesting suggestion to point out how much you could save under Medicare Part B, made by Senator Hank Brown of Colorado,
mm-hmm.
who said that if you limited Medicare Part B, that part of Medicare that pays physicians, to increases tied to the cost of living and to the increase in numbers of people enrolled under Medicare Part B, that you would save $257 billion in the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his second suggestion for controlling the budget.
Mm-hmm. So we're saying that physicians should earn no more in addition each year than the average cost of living increase. Is that what he's saying?
That isn't precisely what he's saying. He says that Medicare, which is a federal government
mm-hmm.
Part B program,
sure.
of which currently 25% is supported out of taxes, 25% mm-hmm. is supported out of premiums paid by the individual enrolled under Medicare,
mm-hmm.
and 75% is out of your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That program should not pay more than for the cost of living increase and the expected increase in numbers 65 and over that would be
enrolled. Now, is this for a per procedure basis, or is it for a total?
They did not. Well, the current program is...
current program, of course, is per procedure.
Is per procedure. In fact, I think there's 800 diagnostic-related groups.
Mm-hmm.
Under the program. We have a huge bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
as you well know,
sure.
in Medicare. And so what happens when it pays only 25% by the individual, rather than the total cost of the operation, is that the individual considers the price to be what he pays out of pocket.
Exactly. The problem, though, with proposals like that, and especially ones that just affect one segment of the healthcare industry, I think can be demonstrated very clearly just by an example right here on the Stanford University campus. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago that talked about open heart procedures. And Medicare will reimburse the Stanford University Hospital $41,000 for an open heart procedure, coronary bypass operation, I think was a specific operation. But it actually costs somewhere in the order of $60,000. This was not coronary bypass, but a much more sophisticated operation, $60,000, so that the hospital has to turn around and charge privately insured patients $81,000 for the same operation. So, in effect, every time the federal government squeezes the Medicare or Medicaid payment rates, two things happen. One is that the hospitals and physicians have to raise their rates on privately insured patients to recoup the loss of income. And the second thing that they do is they cut back on making the operations.
But that isn't all that occurs. I have been advising business
mm-hmm.
for a long number
mm-hmm.
of years. And it was business firms that pushed the idea there should be a single charge, hospital mm-hmm. and surgeon together, mm-hmm. for the whole coronary bypass, so that when in California, and I include LA area mm-hmm. too, this charges grew out of line with the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. Business firms such as the Gillette Company mm-hmm. looked into how they could get these operations for their employees for less. Mm-hmm. And of course, they found out in Texas that the costs of a coronary bypass, hospital and surgeon together, is less than it is in Van Nuys, plants, mm-hmm. Los Angeles area. And it was cheaper to pay the way mm-hmm. of employees and their families to go have a particular operation. Mm-hmm. This has grown. After this was explored by the government and other firms took it up, it is continuing. And it is helping, or rather instituting mergers, vertical mergers, mm-hmm. among hospitals and physician groups, mm-hmm. especially in this area of California, mm-hmm. which I know about.
And what is going to be the implication of that?
Well, we're overbedded in this area, mm-hmm. which I would go all the way to San Jose and mm-hmm. include it. Some people would go into San Francisco and even north into Ukiah, but mm-hmm. I think that's stretching it. Just yeah. take the San Jose area, mm-hmm. which is a very large city now.
Yes.
And most of the hospitals have less than 50% rate occupancy. Mm-hmm. That is, means they have excess beds which aren't being used.
So we need more sick people.
No, we don't need more sick people. This is the result of the technology. Uh-huh. As I said before on the cataract, mm-hmm. from 1 week in the hospital to mm-hmm. 1 hour. Mm-hmm. Well, this is occurring in all the other areas too. Surgery is now very small incision mm-hmm. surgery, and that's sure. what's reducing the hospital stay. Mm-hmm. So I think what we need to do is close some hospitals.
Certainly makes sense in a lot of cases, because I know even back in the late 70s, we were seeing that problem in a lot of areas. The question is, how much does that contribute to the rising cost of healthcare? I don't know. I don't know how much it does.
Oh, I think it contributes a great deal, because the hospitals stay in business. They may use 40% of their beds. Mm-hmm. Basically, some of them could become long-term care mm-hmm. facilities. Others, in many parts of the country, are very small. I was on the Health Services Industry Committee, which was President Nixon's mm-hmm. price control in the health services, 1971-74. And I might say that didn't work, and I could explain why. But
well, I think that might be a very, very interesting area to go into, because as rumors are having it, President Clinton wants to take the current Medicare price control system and also Medicaid price control system and spread it throughout the economy to in effect impose industry-wide price controls on all medical services. Obviously, one positive effect of that would be that it would reduce the kind of cost shifting that I described a moment ago, where you undervalue services in, say, the Medicare program and costs get shifted to private payers. That could, in theory at least, would not happen under a universal price control system.
Well, that was the Nixon system. It was a universal. The reason it did not work was because physicians broke out different procedures.
Unbundling, in other words.
Unbundling, mm-hmm. and it continues to this day. The standing joke of the committee was when price control ended, that next they will charge for a handshake, because a handshake is diagnostic. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you look at the specifics of that period, mm-hmm. you find that although the prices were reduced from 3 times the inflation rate to 2 times the inflation rate rise, which after all, and I think the Clinton administration is very correctly asking, why should it be two times? Why not just be the inflation mm-hmm. rate rise? But if you reduce it and you increase the number of units, the procedures just jump tremendously, and mostly by unbundling.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's this notion that you allude to here in terms of the rise in the inflation rate, that there is some ideal level of healthcare spending. I mean, obviously, our healthcare spending has been growing not only in absolute amounts, but also as a percentage of GNP. We've gone from 5% of GNP in the 1950s to 13 or 14% of the GNP now, and headed upward toward 20% to 30% of the GNP sometime early in the first third of the 21st century, if rates continue as they do
I
now.
I don't believe in
now,
straight line
no,
projections.
No, obviously that's not going to happen, but it could.
I don't think so.
The point is, we're buying a lot more healthcare than we used to. And how much is too much? I mean, it's easy to sit at a computer with an econometric model and say, okay, this is the ideal level of healthcare, 15.2% of GNP. But how do you make the micro decisions who not to provide healthcare for?
That's why we need a consumer-driven marketplace. I think the basic problem with our medical care system is it just isn't like all the other markets in the United States, and not for the reason that people who are against competitive markets project. They say people can't understand it, the consumer. But you don't have to understand the process of manufacture. Mm-hmm. I don't have to understand how a stereo is manufactured. I can listen to it and maybe select the one I like best. Mm-hmm. I don't have to understand how an operation is done. I can find out, and thanks to the Reagan administration, we now have outcomes by hospital and in some states like Pennsylvania by surgeon mm-hmm. of operations. And so it isn't a blind selection. Intelligent, capable consumers can find out where they will have the best mortality outcome, and many do today.
Well, let's talk about that, because outcomes research, I think, holds a lot of promise, but I think there are a couple of aspects of it that are worth exploring. One is just what you talked about, the published outcome research, the mortality data for individual surgeons and hospitals. One of the things that really bothers me with that kind of data in terms of, quote, comparison shopping, is that the patients that different hospitals and different surgeons operate on are not all the same.
True.
And if incomes start to be related to outcomes in that fashion, you're going to have the situation, like many presidents have and chiefs of staff have been criticized. I think Jim Baker, for instance, was when he was Reagan's chief of staff, was criticized for picking only winning battles. And he developed a very admirable reputation of going before Congress with administration proposals and winning. Of course, he never took the really hard issues to Congress, and so he had a leg up in winning. And my concern is whether surgeons are only going to take the easy cases if their incomes start depending on their outcomes.
I don't think so. I mean, you can correct, and the statistics are now being corrected and their annual statistics mm-hmm. for, say, a hospital, since you mentioned Stanford Medical.
Mm-hmm.
They would, of course, in heart transplants, get very difficult cases, mm-hmm. and they can be corrected for that. That is, there are statistical methods
sure.
for correcting for the bad risk. I think that basically it is a good thing that Good Housekeeping mm-hmm. magazine, of all places, issued lists of hospitals and top surgeons and other specialists in the last few years. U.S. News and World Report had a list of the 100 best hospitals mm-hmm. by diagnostic category this past year. These are things that people can read and assimilate. And in cases of terminal disease or terminal conditions, the average person will seek the best.
I don't think it's a bad idea. I think, however, we have to use that kind of information very carefully because, as you well know, as we were talking about before we started this discussion, the infant mortality rate and the death rate is often used as a comparison of health systems performance, and it is true that the United States has a much lower or much higher infant mortality rate than most of the other developed countries of the world. And many people, many healthcare analysts and political commentators use that data to say we're spending all these hundreds of billions of dollars on healthcare and not getting our money's worth, when you and I both know that infant mortality is determined by many things other than the state of a nation's healthcare system. A good comparison is between the United States and Canada. One of the main differences, of course, is we have a much higher, much more concentrated poverty problem here. We have much higher use and abuse of drugs and alcohol among pregnant mothers. We have much more violence in the inner cities. And those factors, more than anything else, tend to drive up the infant mortality rate.
Accidents are the fourth cause of death in the United States.
Accidents is a very important factor. But one of the factors that relates directly to the healthcare system is that because of our higher technology levels, we have a much greater capability to save at-risk babies, low birth weight babies, extremely premature babies. Our ability to save a baby weighing under 2.2 pounds has gone up in just two decades from 6% to 48%.
I know because University of California, San Francisco is one of the leaders in this area, and so is the Stanford's Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing what we can do.
It is amazing.
And the effect of that is twofold. First of all, in many hospitals in Canada, they don't even try to save low birth weight babies.
Sure.
They don't go on the infant mortality statistics, even because they're not counted as infant mortality until after they pass 10 days or so. They're counted as stillbirths.
Is the stillbirth rate higher in Canada?
It probably isn't because the same behavioral factors that cause higher infant mortality rates in the United States also tend to cause higher stillbirth rates. They're probably not, although you could do statistical adjustment. But the second factor beyond that is that many of the infants we save, 2-3 pound infants, go on to survive 6 months or a year, but are still so seriously impaired that they are much more at risk of dying early. So we have a much higher infant mortality rate in large part because we have so much better technology. Otherwise, these babies would never survive that long. But I want to get back to another aspect of the question you raised that brought this on in terms of the outcomes research. And I think it's a much more fundamental question. Even if we could assume that outcome research was flawless in terms of measuring true performance, and even if we could assume that consumers would select the best, quote unquote, producers of healthcare services, is that going to solve our healthcare cost explosion? And I would argue that it would not, for a very simple but often overlooked reason. The reason that markets for services and goods work, as you well know, and anybody who studied Economics 101 knows, is you have an intersection of a supply curve and a demand curve. Well, the demand curve, basically, the philosophy of the demand curve is people will consume until the marginal cost of purchasing that particular good or service equals the marginal benefit that it returns to the consumer. So that if they have something that's going to return $100 worth of benefit to them but cost them $200, they won't buy it. The problem with healthcare and the reason it is so unlike any other service is that it has a potentially infinite marginal benefit. If you don't get a haircut this week, or if you don't get your computer serviced, or you don't get your automobile serviced, I mean, you may be disappointed, but you'll get it done the next week. But if you die, that's the end of everything. And so there is a very, very high cost to not having that service. And so I really believe that one of the things that most importantly, that most powerfully drives the accelerating health costs is not the fact that people are poor shoppers, but that the cost of not having service or not having the guarantee that the service provides can be so high that people want that security that additional Medicare provides them, medical care provides them.
Let me be the devil's advocate for a moment.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It is true that a large part of medical care costs are delivered in the last year of life. And that argument applies to that. But after all, that is far less than probably 10% of incidents. I don't say of total costs, mm-hmm. which are probably closer to 30% of the total cost bill mm-hmm. is delivered in the last year of life. Mm-hmm. But basically, a very large amount of medical care is for chronic disease and for minor disease. Mm-hmm. And in those instances, informed shopping, in which the dollar comes out of the consumer's pocket rather than out of the employer's pocket, because the employer is the largest payer. Mm-hmm. In the private sense, he's equal almost to the government. The federal mm-hmm. government, he is equal mm-hmm. as a payer. Mm-hmm. And basically, this is, to my mm-hmm. mind, one of the reasons why the costs have gone up so extraordinarily. They've risen so rapidly recently. We didn't always have the employer pay health insurance premiums. Mm-hmm. That evolved in 1941. When World War II clamped a ceiling on wages, mm-hmm. and the only way employers could get out from under and attract good new employees was to offer so-called fringe benefits. Mm-hmm. Fringe benefits included vitamin pills, they included time off to have one's hair done, and so forth. But the one that was most popular was the health insurance premium, and therefore it increased. The federal government made it a subsidy. What they did was say you can expense against your revenues the payment of health insurance premiums. And corporations grabbed onto that as a way to attract employees during rather a lengthy war, so mm-hmm. that they grew in size and number. We are the only country in the world that does financing of medical care in this very strange fashion, at mm-hmm. least strange in my mind. Mm-hmm. As a result, the employee or the average consumer, the patient, if you will, does not pay out of pocket anywhere near the cost of what they're mm-hmm. consuming. And this was given in lieu of wages. Mm-hmm. Now we are saddled with a $60 billion subsidy, mm-hmm. which has been distorted in the literature or in the newspapers recently. They say, well, we should tax the benefits of employees. What we should do is something else. We should cap the amount the employer can expense against revenues for health insurance premiums and squeeze down on this. This I proposed many years ago, and so did Alan Enthoven, and I'm mm-hmm. sure he's really still for it, but sees no way of getting from here to there. And I think that's what the problem of the whole health crisis is how do we improve it? Many people know that if we could get rid of that and take whatever money is the $60 billion and use it to cover the people who do not have health insurance, but have them pay for health insurance out of their own pockets, mm-hmm. we would come out far better. I don't say we'd control costs. Mm-hmm. I agree with you that benefits of medical technology are so high that people will prefer to spend their money on that rather than on other goods and mm-hmm. services. But to the degree that they're spending it now on it is not influenced by the price.
No, but let me take your argument one step further. Rather than just capping the amount that employers can deduct for health insurance, which I think, given the current system, is certainly better than what we have now, let me step back from that and say that if you listen to the healthcare debate, there is one point of agreement that we have to maintain the employer-based health insurance system, either through some form of player pay, or
that's
where
an
employer
agreement
mandates
among the players
among,
would benefit
among
the insurance
among
companies,
among the players, exactly,
but not among the consumers.
Why?
Which I'm trying to speak
why?
For.
I mean, it strikes me it struck me when I first began looking at the healthcare issue that it was absurd that we have a system in which health insurance benefits are paid by the employer. No other insurance is paid by the employer. We don't pay our homeowners insurance to the employer. We don't pay our life insurance to the employer. We don't pay our auto insurance
some
to the employer.
Some life insurance.
Some, but in general, it is not. Why in the world do we pay health insurance? I mean, it's absurd in two fashions. One, health certainly contributes to productivity, but so do many other things. Happy employees contribute to productivity. And there are many things that contribute to productivity much more than health insurance. Education and training is a very good example. Think how productive our workforce would be if instead of spending the billions of dollars that employers spend on health insurance, if they spent that same amount of money on job-specific employee training. We would have a workforce that was as well-trained at all levels as any in the world. But the second absurdity of it is that health costs, therefore, become a very important factor in wages. And so not only do health costs drag down the economy just through the macroeconomic effect of increasing federal spending and increasing the budget deficit, but they also increase wages and make us much less competitive overseas. Why do we even
run it
through the employers?
Well, I don't know if they increased wages as much as they substituted for the real wage increases that might have occurred during the late 70s and early 80s. The evidence shows that real wages on average in the United States, money wages, have not increased in real terms.
Yeah.
And this means, to my mind, there was some increase in productivity. Mm-hmm. That also can be proven, so it's substituted for the real wage increase. And I do not believe that this is a thing we should continue.
I don't either.
And I believe that, you know, I guess it was in the early 80s, I advised the Singapore government, and they developed this Provident Fund plan, which I did not fully involved in, but I was involved enough to know that people could save, those who are not poverty, not in the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. These other people could save a bit in their own personal IRAs. I am not against exploring the use of existing IRAs for medical costs. Why should you be forced to wait for retirement if you are, so we say, dying and you wish to use it?
Or you have extraordinary medical expenditures for any reason.
So that this is another alternative. There are lots of things being talked about. I do not know what evolved from the Health Task Force. And I hope they get a good solution. But I don't think retaining and allowing it to continuously grow the subsidy to employers for health insurance benefits is a wise thing.
But there's more than just the subsidy. I'm troubled by the entire notion of employers making the selection, because if you work for an employer, of course, one of the problems now is that many employers don't offer health insurance, and so that's the main reason we have so many uninsured families, is they work full time, but they work for an employer who doesn't offer health insurance. But even if they do, individuals are constrained to select only those plans that the employer happens to provide. And a great many employers provide only one health plan, maybe with a handful of options, but there's no real choice there. And even if we have managed competition, which has become sort of a deus ex machina for the healthcare cost crisis, If it's still based on employer selection, then you're still going to have a situation where individuals really cannot exercise their choice in selecting the kind of health plan that's best for them.
I think consumer choice is limited in other ways too, because you have state mandates of things you must cover.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes it expensive. The state of California under Medi-Cal, which is their Medicaid, you have 21 items that are covered. Mm-hmm. And people think of health insurance as hospital and physician, maybe nursing care, maybe drugs, but they don't think of acupuncture, mm-hmm. physical therapy, and lots of things, all of which might be good, but might be considered to be fringes mm-hmm. above the basic medical care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know precisely how you move it from a back to a system of basic medical care, mm-hmm. but maybe that is something else that we should look at. Certainly government-paid health insurance, which is Medicare and Medicaid, for years was argued by the more conservative people, such as myself, I guess, who believe that medical care, government paid, should be to a minimal level of benefits.
Mm-hmm.
It is not. And this is another problem that should be put out there.
Well, that does appear to be one area in which the Clinton administration is at least focusing in the right direction, is creating a basic level of care from which people could then move in other directions, but it's not clear how other care could be brought about. Presumably what they would do is, if they run it through a managed competition plan, is make employees pay more for different types of health insurance, which I think is an excellent idea. And it's exactly the kind of thing that I've advocated as well. That in order, the only way to control health costs is to make the cost more apparent to the individual consumer, rather than imposing, say, price controls that give physicians the control over whether or not they're going to offer the service, to let them charge whatever they want, whatever the market will bear. And let individuals see that cost and then decide themselves whether they want to bear that cost through higher insurance premiums. Two things will happen in that case. Either if it is a very desired service, even if it's very expensive, people will be willing to pay the higher insurance premiums for that.
Do you see any role for the Reagan-proposed voucher systems?
Well, let me finish this argument, and then I will respond to that. If it's a very desirable service, people will be willing to pay the higher insurance premiums and be able to receive that service. Whereas under a price control system, that they might not even have that option. On the other hand, if it is a service that consumers perceive as being is more expensive than it's worth, then they will not purchase that insurance. People will have that operation or procedure or test less often, and physicians will either have to lower the price or they aren't going to be doing too many of those procedures or tests. And I think the Reagan administration proposal for vouchers it basically goes in the right direction. I'm very most attracted to the form of it that's been developed by Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation, the refundable tax credit, which operates effectively like a voucher and would substitute for the current employer deduction, and therefore move the system out of the employer sphere and make it an individual decision, as I think it must be. Where I disagree with Stuart is that he would expand the Medicaid program and allow poor people to greater access to Medicaid. And I think that's exactly the wrong way to go about things. I think if there is one real disaster in the U.S. healthcare system right now. It's the Medicaid program. And it's a disaster because the reimbursement rates are so tragically low that the quality of care provided is worse than the quality of care provided in many third world countries. And what we need to do is make it possible for poor people to belong to the exact same healthcare system as everybody else. And that could happen.
That was its intent.
That was the
intent was that I did not think, going back in the mid-1960s, that people believed that physicians would say, I will not serve Medicaid patients, which is what you're saying, because of the low rate of return. It varies by the 50 states or among the 50 states. In California, I think it's a fairly good program, except here it's upset by the immigrants.
Yeah.
People cross the line to have their baby in the United States. They want a child that's an American citizen.
And really, Medicaid's problem is partly that, and it's partly an invisible effect of Medicare, because when Medicaid was initially enacted, it was designed to be a program for the poor. Now, only about a third of the money goes to help poor people. The rest of it goes to help elderly people who have been impoverished by medical expenses because Medicare would not pay for those expenses. So what we have is a system where Medicare's price controls reduce the level of services provided to elderly people. In particular, Medicare pays for almost no nursing home care. And so,
I hope it won't either.
Well, the problem, though, is that that's an entire different discussion, the issue of long-term care. But the problem is that these people then have to, quote, spin down and they become impoverished, and therefore the Medicaid system, which is supposed to help basically poor families, is deprived of funds and because
you know,
of the growing volume of expenses for older people.
80% of medical care is usually quoted as the correct figure for that which is ineffective in the outcome of disease. And I dare say that if a good portion of the Medicare money was spent for improving the nutrition of these people that can't afford medical care, that it would improve their health far more than the medical care.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it is certainly true that 80 to 90% of our medical care is of unproven effectiveness. The problem is we don't know in which 80 or 90% of the cases that's true. But it is certainly true that behavioral changes, nutrition and other behaviors would make far more difference than any increase in medical expenditures whatsoever. And that's a very difficult problem to deal with, and it's one that we're going to have to start confronting as we move to a new healthcare system. Healthcare advocates have always said that we need to make greater healthcare available.
This is where I agree with the Clinton administration. Prevention is more important probably than the acute medical care at the top. And that's why you need an emphasis on primary care physicians.
Exactly.
The problem is how do you get there, though?
Exactly.
When the specialist is trained.
Well, that's exactly right. And let's not give the Clinton administration too much credit on that, because former Surgeon General Koop made that one of his, in the Reagan administration, made that his primary emphasis on health care. Unfortunately, people in the Reagan administration didn't listen to him as much as they should have. But we will be facing a very lively debate in the weeks and months ahead, and I hope that we've had a chance here to, if not clear up some issues, at least raise some different points of view and hopefully puncture this growing sense that we know what all the problems are and we know the solutions, and now we just need to write out the details. I think the deeper we get into this debate, the more we'll discover that not only do we not know what the solutions are, but we don't know what many of the right questions are. And we need to start asking some of those right questions so that hopefully within the next few years we will be developing some of the right answers that will bring us to a healthcare system that provides true quality healthcare for all Americans at an affordable cost. Thank you.